It's Thursday, April 2nd, 2009, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Good day, Stashers, and welcome to the podcast. First things first, want to correct an error I made on yesterday's podcast when I mentioned the upcoming 37th annual Hash Bash. It's the 38th annual Hash Bash, taking place this Saturday at the Diag on the University of Michigan's Ann Arbor campus. The event celebrates the release from prison of John Sinclair, who was made famous in the John Lennon song. One of the stories we've been talking about a lot here at the Stash is the recent joking remarks by President Obama when reacting to the number one question about legalization of marijuana, and a lot of you are very angry about that, but from my point of view, I'm really happy about it. Couldn't have been a better recruiting tool. I am getting so many inquiries from people all around the country for whom that remark, that flippant remark by the president, was the catalyst they needed to get started in marijuana law reform. I've got people contacting me from Atlanta, Georgia, North and South Carolina, Sacramento and Santa Maria, California, a couple of emails from South Florida, even got an email from Council Bluffs, Iowa, Kentucky, Duluth, Minnesota, Memphis, Tennessee, West Virginia, Virginia, Southwest Washington, and even Utah. Yes, I've got people in Utah looking to start a Utah Normal chapter. If I can get a Normal chapter in Utah, folks, I'm telling you, that is the little gold star on my report card for the year. So if you're interested in starting a Normal chapter, send your email to chapters@normal.org. They come straight to me. I'll put you in touch with some of these other people, and together we can fight adult marijuana prohibition. Now, coming up on the podcast, we've got your hemp headlines today with the opening statements of Gil Kerlikowske as he's being confirmed for the drug czar position, and a look at Senator Webb's bill for prison sentencing reform. In our Southern California scene, we'll be visiting with our cannabis correspondent Terry Joyce, who brings back Dejay Kuti from the Patients Advocacy Network at CannabisSavesLives.com. We're going to be talking about the San Francisco DEA raid, and DeJay's got some very interesting insight on that. Our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com, feature some rock here for Rockin' Thursday. And in our second interview segment, Cannabis Conversations, we're going to begin a two-part interview with the founder of Normal, Keith Straub, discussing the book High in America, The True Tale of American Marijuana and the Founding of Normal. This was a book written back in the 80s, and I had a few stashers on the Fresh Stash asking about it and what Keith's opinions were. And I said, well, let's just go to the source. So the first part of that interview is today, and we'll conclude the interview on Friday's Stash. Hey, does anyone out there still refer to marijuana in lids? It's time for your Normal Daily Audio Stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Statement by Gil Kerlikowske to the Senate at Drug Czar confirmation hearings. It has been my privilege to lead two of this country's largest police departments over a period of 13 years. In my current role as the Chief of Police in Seattle, where I have led for nearly 9 years, I have brought innovative solutions to the problems of drugs and crime, and their effect on society. A key element in my approach while in Seattle has involved enlisting the support of the entire community to reduce crime. While this approach is commonly referred to as community policing, I prefer it be recognized as policing. The transparency and collaborative approach of this concept has ultimately led to the lowest drug use and serious crime rates in Seattle since 1967. My goal is to use similar principles in the development, articulation, and implementation of an effective, comprehensive, and coordinated national drug control strategy. Upon confirmation, I will immediately coordinate with my colleagues in the federal government, as well as our counterparts at the state and local level, to ensure that the national drug control strategy is balanced and comprehensive, based upon the best possible understanding of the drug threat and incorporates a science-based approach to public policy. Vigorously implemented through the development of a national drug budget that contains proven, effective programs and rigorously assessed and adapted to changing circumstances. I will set a goal for the development of a strong, transparent monitoring system. While highly complex, performance evaluation of the national drug strategy is key to both validating and tracking the efficacy of the strategic goals and objectives established by the national drug control strategy and the individual programs which are funded to support it. Hey folks, when it comes to drug policy, if we're going to have innovative solutions incorporating a science-based approach to public policy with proven, effective programs that are rigorously assessed by a strong, transparent monitoring system, we win. Every study of public policy in marijuana has recommended its decriminalization. All the science on cannabis use proves it to be less harmful to users and society than alcohol and tobacco. We win. Finally, some change we can believe in. Not all federal politicians believe that marijuana law reform is a laughing matter. Senators Jim Webb, Democrat of Virginia, and Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania, along with 15 co-sponsors, have introduced legislation in Congress to critically evaluate America's drugs and prisons policies. Senate Bill 714, the National Criminal Justice Commission Act of 2009, seeks to establish a blue ribbon commission to, quote, undertake a comprehensive review of the criminal justice system, make findings related to current federal and state criminal justice policies and practices, and make reform recommendations for the President, Congress, and state governments to improve public safety, cost effectiveness, overall prison administration, and fairness in the implementation of the nation's criminal justice system, end quote. Specifically, the commission will examine, quote, current drug policy and its impact on incarceration, crime and violence, sentencing, and reentry programs, including an analysis of the general availability of drugs in our society, the impact and effectiveness of current policies on reducing that availability, and on the incidence of crime, and, in the case of criminal offenders, the availability of drug treatment programs before, during, and after incarceration. House passes measure to let FDA regulate tobacco. The House voted Thursday to grant Food and Drug Administration sweeping powers to regulate the production and marketing of tobacco products. Under the bill, H.R. 1256, which passed 298-112, the FDA would be able to regulate nicotine levels, and makers of tobacco products would face tough new marketing and advertising restrictions. The bill now goes to the Senate, where lawmakers are expected to face intense lobbying from the White House to clear it. Supporters say the measure faces its best chance of becoming law since a massive effort to regulate tobacco and codify a landmark settlement with the tobacco industry collapsed in the Senate a decade ago. Republicans said it defies common sense to ask the FDA, which approves products if they are proven to be safe and effective, to regulate nicotine. Excuse me, is this the same FDA that won't approve a product that is proven to be safe and effective? If this bill passes and the FDA begins regulating tobacco, then it becomes even more absurd for them not to approve cannabis. Of course, they cannot, while cannabis is still Schedule 1, a designation meaning the drug has no accepted medical value in the United States, despite 13 states in the United States accepting the medical value of cannabis. The DEA, Attorney General, or President would have to change the designation of cannabis from Schedule 1 to at least Schedule 2, or completely deschedule it, as logic would dictate, which they can do as an executive measure. It would not have to be approved by Congress or the courts. Of course, that would be the Drug Enforcement Administration, which is also charged with enforcing the laws against hemp that is not a drug, or the Attorney General, who once fought for 5-year mandatory minimums for marijuana sales in D.C., or the President who, quote, inhaled frequently, that was the point, end quote, and now can't stop giggling about it. And they're the ones who wonder what the hell we've been smoking?
Marijuana is an addictive drug, which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death.
Marijuana is the most violence-causing drug in the history of mankind.
If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face to face with the monster of marijuana, he would drop dead from fright.
Newt Gingrich, we should have Singapore-style drug tests for Americans. Want a clear sign that we're winning the war on drugs? When the prohibitionists have to offer a radical and extreme solution to drug use, you know you're on the right track. Bill O'Reilly took a trip to Singapore, and so in 5 days he figures out the remedy to drugs.
Now, they have no drug problem in Singapore at all. Number one, because they hang drug dealers. They execute them. And number two, the market is very thin, because when they catch you using, you go away with a mandatory rehab. You go to some rehab center, which they have, which the government has built. The United States does not have the stomach for that. We don't have the stomach for that, Mr. Speaker.
Yep, that's right. Mandatory random drug testing for every citizen. Execute citizens that have more drugs on them than you want. Any amount will do. This isn't just big government, it's totalitarian government. It's a government that gives you the freedom to do what you should, as dictated by the elite ruling class. Your life is no longer yours. Your life belongs to the state from beginning to end. Surely Newt Gingrich, one of the heads of the small government, get government out of your life party, would strenuously disagree with this most fascist policy? Not on your life.
Well, I think it's time we get the stomach for that, Bill. And I think we need a program. I would dramatically expand testing. I think we have, and I agree with you, I would try to use rehabilitation. I'd make it mandatory. And I think we have every right as a country to demand of our citizens that they quit doing illegal things, which are funding both in Afghanistan and Mexico and in Colombia, people who are destroying civilization.
That's right. The country has every right to demand from you to stop doing things that the government determines illegal. You have no rights. The government has total and absolute rule in Newt Gingrich's America. Newt, in a single sentence, sells out every philosophy he has ever expressed a belief in to win the war on Americans using marijuana. It takes a lot of desperation and futility to bring a mind like Newt to this point, and the drug war's twisted logic is twisting Newt into a pretzel. The moralists in this country have tried everything in their power, including shredding the Constitution, and still, it's not enough. Our time has come.
So here's the deal. We've got this new president who seems really cool. I mean, the guy's well-spoken, he's open-minded, he seems to listen to people, and he's extremely well-educated. I mean, he graduated from Harvard Law School. But this is a guy who's admitted to smoking marijuana, that illegal leaf that just ruins people's lives. How could the president of the United States have ever done such a thing? Maybe because he knew it was less addictive than both alcohol and nicotine, and knew it can be consumed responsibly. But it's probably been a while since he smoked a joint. So if I had one thing to say to Barack Obama about cannabis, it would probably be something like, "Hey dude, I'm one of 80 million people in your country who has smoked marijuana, and so are you." Or maybe I would say over 700,000 people were arrested in this last year for marijuana-related charges. Or something like, "Let's re-examine this law altogether." Or possibly that $1.3 billion is spent annually fighting marijuana, not including the cost of prison management and construction. Or I might just end up saying, "Hey man, you know the facts. Let's fix this mess."
Weed.
That's Hoovy Valley, Hoovy Ha.
Weed.
Where any office boy or young mechanic.
Now it's time for a report from the epicenter of American cannabis culture with our Southern California correspondent. You know her from ComedyNation.com and her appearance as a finalist on season one of NBC's Last Comic Standing. It's our friend, cannabis comedian and marijuana activist, the lovely and talented Terry Joyce. Hey, Terry, welcome back to the show. How's it going?
It's going well, but I actually had a little bit of stress this morning.
Uh-oh. We don't want to have any stress,
yeah.
Terry.
Yeah, I checked my email, and I actually had an email from the it was from the FBI.
Oh.
Yeah, and it really freaked me out.
Yeah.
I opened it up. Yeah, the FBI. I thought, great, you know, with my history, what do they want from me now, you know? And I opened it up, and it was from the Anti-Terrorist and Monetary Crime Division.
Oh.
And upon reading it, of course, I found out that it was a phishing email, but they basically claimed that they had information that my funds were on hold. And,
I see.
I had no idea that I even had funds. Like, what funds are you talking about? And it says it's a part of our duty to assist anyone who faces such a problem. And they found out that my transactions were extremely genuine. And then, of course, they wanted my full name, which I thought they already had.
Sure.
And my address. But what they were saying that is that they were going to issue a bank card, an ATM card that I can withdraw $5,000 a day from anywhere in the world.
Well, isn't that sweet?
Isn't that sweet? And I thought, well, if it were true, I'd take the money and open a medical marijuana dispensary.
Yeah.
And then go, ha ha ha.
I just like the idea that the FBI needs to ask you for your name and address.
The joke. I mean, it's like, I know that I'm already probably on file with them. They have my picture.
Exactly. I got your fingerprints too, don't they?
Right.
Oh. Yeah. Well, maybe all your funds were left to you by some Nigerian prince somewhere.
Well, you know, I'm hoping for the prince, you know, take your Nigerian prince back to, United States and buy, the affordable housing that will be available soon.
That's true. Yeah. In fact, speaking of that, I just saw a really scary statistic the other day that the average home price in Detroit, Michigan is $18,000. You can get a home, you can get a 3-bedroom home for 18 grand.
Oh,
amazing,
I love
huh?
It. I don't want to live in Detroit. But
well, maybe that's the reason there. Oh boy. Well, you know, we've been looking at California here with what's going on with medical marijuana for a long time now. And we were so excited. We talked to you a couple weeks ago. We were so excited about that Eric Holder announcement that they wouldn't bust any dispensaries anymore unless they were breaking both federal and state law. And what do you know? He makes that announcement and we get another raid. What do you know about that? What can you tell us about that new raid?
Well, we do have someone to speak on the new raid, and we're going to bring we're bringing back DeJay Kuti from the Patient Advocacy Network. She's been doing a lot of work about it, and she's here to share that with us.
All right, welcome back, DeJay.
Good afternoon. Yeah, no, thanks for having me again. Yeah, it was very disappointing, and you know, it sent a ripple, of course, through San Francisco, where with the announcement of Eric Holder, everyone wanted information. Were they indeed in violation of state and federal? Were local law enforcement involved or present at the raid? The DEA later made claims that there were potential tax problems, and we already have a statement from Betty Yee of the Board of Equalization that indeed the dispensary did not have any state tax violations or problems, and they were not being investigated. And the San Francisco County Sheriff's Department acknowledges that they were not involved in an investigation and were not present at the raid. So it does come back to it being a single-handed DEA smash-and-grab raid in San Francisco, and they haven't had a raid in San Francisco in quite some time.
So you're saying, according to,
I have my theory as to why the DEA raided them, but
well, let's get to that in a second. But I are you saying then it appears from what you're able to find at the San Francisco city and county level that and with the Board of Equalization that there were no state law violations?
No, they all acknowledge that they were not investigating any violations, and they were not aware of any violations, and they were not involved in the raid that took place last week.
Well, let's go to your theory then, DeJay. What do you theorize here is the reason behind this latest DEA?
The DEA probably doesn't think that San Francisco's actually part of America.
Well, that's a theory.
It was a change in American policy, and San Francisco is not really part of America. So I think that's maybe the logic that they're using by going in. But no, seriously, I'll leave the comedy to Terry. thanks. I came up with that in the bathtub this morning. It's like, well, why, you know, why really were they? Well, maybe they just don't think SF is part of America.
Yeah.
It did, you know, we had an action up there soon after, and it garnered some media, but more importantly, it got us an emergency meeting with Nancy Pelosi's district office to open up a dialogue and investigate this further, and work even more closely with the White House, the Department of Justice, and the House Judiciary Committee to actually get these policies in writing and enacted in any way that's going to facilitate the DEA getting the message that this isn't what our new administration wants.
Yeah, have you heard of any repercussions or anyone being held accountable at the federal level for violating what's supposed to be this new federal policy? Or are you saying that because it's not written down in stone as a policy, they don't really have a leg to stand on?
I think that's pretty much where what we're trying to find out. I don't know if there have been any repercussions. You know, I don't know that we would readily and easily hear about that. But I think that because this whole issue of medical marijuana is so new, from the very, very local patient level all the way to now Washington trying to deal with it, you know, my understanding from Pelosi's office is because the president said it's a new policy, that it is indeed a new policy. Granted, it still doesn't change federal law. And the moment we have a new president or, you know, a new attorney general, that policy can easily dissolve and probably would. So I think it is important that we do get some type of order in writing from the president. And then, of course, we're going to need to work really hard to get Congress to actually change the law.
Are the medical marijuana activists there in California banding together for some sort of action or presentation to Attorney General Holder and President Obama?
We already have been. We've already been communicating and working with them. We, as far as an action is concerned, we're considering an action next week where we actually take a rather large memo with us to the DEA's office and make sure they understand the new change in policy and ask for our freedom and our property back and to no longer have these heavy-handed raids where they come in armed and using very frightening tactics.
Yeah. We look forward to a protest like that. And when it takes place, can you get us some photos and maybe some audio?
Yeah, I'll certainly try. I'll work on that with Terry.
Oh, yeah. I would love to do that.
That would be great.
We have, it may possibly be the end of next week. I know our friends in San Francisco want to do it first thing Monday morning. But in LA, it is a little more difficult to herd the cats. And so, we may shoot for, the end of next week for our, multi-city action.
All right. Well, keep us posted. We'll announce it on our calendar and on the podcast so people can get involved. And just at this point right now, if people want to get further involved with your work, DeJay, and trying to help to protect medical rights in California, can you give our listeners some websites or phone numbers they might contact?
Yeah, they can. Anything they need to know about our mission and what we do and how to get a hold of us, people can visit us online at CannabisSavesLives.com and sign up for email updates right there on our website.
Oh, perfect. CannabisSavesLives.com. We'll make sure to put that up on the post as well. And before we wrap things up, Terry, anything else you'd like to say to our audience?
I would. I just want to let everyone know that we are going to do one last benefit for Richard McCabe and Joanne Kay.
All right.
And Pan, of course, has been very helpful in their campaign of keeping Grandma out of jail campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And this is their final fundraiser. It's April 4th at the Castle Inn. It's from 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. The address is 1388 North Golden Slippers Lane in Landers, California at 9. And zip code, if you MapQuest or however, 92285. There's going to be a barbecue, an auction, live band, comedy. We're going to do the Sexy Misfits, which is a show that I've been working on with Tanya Moon, and it's $15. They only need to raise $1,500 more out of what was owed of $15,000. Everybody's raised all this money. And of course, you know, their case was dropped, so that this is just the last bit of attorney fees. And if anybody out there wants to make a donation, you can go to Pan's website, which is CannabisSavesLives.com, until April 5th of 2009.
All right, so the benefits
We have a donate button there on our website, and anyone who makes a pledge online between now and through Sunday, for people who can't make it out but want to help this elderly couple pay off this bill, is to just simply go to our website and donate. It's tax deductible. So tax deductible donations toward the final very end of their legal defense fund.
That's great. And we've profiled, Rich and Joanne here on the Stash a couple of times. So we want to get as many people and as many donations as we can for them. It's, this Saturday at the Castle Inn. What was the city again?
Landers, California.
Landers, thank you.
San Bernardino County.
It's beautiful. The high desert's beautiful. They could camp out, I'm sure.
There you go.
I mean, there's plenty of places to camp out there.
All right. Well, DeJay Kuti from the Patients Advocacy Network and Terry Joyce, thank you for joining us again here on the Daily Audio Stash.
Thank you.
Thanks, Russ.
If I were to tell you that in America, right now, over 1 million children sell marijuana, what would you think? Would you think that any public policy that creates over 1 million teenage marijuana dealers needs to be re-examined and possibly amended? You would not be alone. The members of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, aka NORML, have been working since 1970 to reform marijuana laws such that responsible adults, not children, sell and use marijuana. Isn't it high time to reform America's misguided marijuana laws? This is Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of NORML in Washington, D.C. Only concerned citizens can effectively end the federal government's nearly 70-year-old prohibition on responsible adult marijuana sales and use. Want to know more about how you can help? Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORMAL, or by visiting the organization's popular and informative webpage at NORML, NORML.org.
We'll be right back.
battle to end adult marijuana prohibition can sometimes seem endlessly frustrating and impossible to overcome. One way we bond as a community and draw strength to continue is by rejuvenating our spirit through art and music. The Marijuana Music Awards exist to recognize those sonic artists in all genres of music who feature a ganja-friendly message to motivate and inspire all the cannabis community. Our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com, feature the finest in blues, rock, jazz, hip-hop, rap, reggae, country, bluegrass, and dance music to enhance that 420 feeling and refresh all you stashers for another day on the front lines of the drug war. Enjoy this cut from MarijuanaMusicAwards.com and visit our blog at stash.normal.org to learn how you can vote for your favorites and enter your toker tunes in the 2009 Marijuana Music Awards. Rockin' Thursday brings us 420 by the Big Fellas. The Big Fellas are a four-piece band from San Diego who create all their own material. Their music is aggressively eclectic and jumps musical genres from jam band to blues, country to funk, and from cabaret to rock. They have many rave reviews, including full of tongue-in-cheek satire, playful lyrics and melodies, and a sophisticated sense of music to suit the topic. The Big Fellas are an intellectual pop fan's dream. Entered in 2009's Marijuana Music Awards Best Pop and Song of the Year, you can vote for the Big Fellas at the Stash. To find out more about the band and grab their CD, check out myspace.com/thebigfellas and bigfellas.net. And registered stashers, you'll get your own MP3 download of this tune. It's the Big Fellas with our favorite time, 420.
Just after class, they got a 86% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Strop, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Legalization, decriminalization, lowest law enforcement priority, medical marijuana, ganja sacrament, consumer cannabis, industrial hemp. The world of marijuana law reform involves many different aspects of cannabis that intersect nearly every public policy discussion in America, including healthcare, the economy, global climate change, law enforcement and prisons, immigration, religion, free speech, energy policy, and war. Now we take a look at how re-legalizing marijuana will change the world in our NORML daily audio stash, Cannabis Conversations.
One of my favorite things about working for NORML and producing the daily audio stash podcast is that when someone brings up a question about marijuana law reform and its history, I've got someone I can talk to. Just recently on the stash, one of our readers was commenting on a book that was written quite a while ago, but this one is a book called High in America, The True Story Behind NORML and the Politics of Marijuana by Patrick Anderson. And it details a lot about NORML's history, and I thought I would just go straight to the source to talk about it. So joining us today is the founder of NORML and a large part of that book, Keith Strop. So Keith, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Russ. Always nice to be with you.
So this is a book, Patrick Anderson. When was this written, this book?
I believe it came out in 80 or 81. I believe that's right. It was just a year or two after I had left NORML the first time. I founded NORML in late 1970 and ran it through 1979. And I believe this was in 80 or 81 when this book came out.
What I find interesting about this is a lot of times we talk about a pendulum in politics swinging from left to right, from permissive to more restrictive, you might say. And lately we've been seeing a big push in the mainstream media and just in popular culture for marijuana legalization and acceptance of the cannabis culture. And probably the last time we saw something like this was your heyday back in the 70s. How would you compare and contrast the two different eras, what happened back in the 70s versus what's happening now?
Well, I think you're right, by the way, that it was in 1975, 76, 77, in those years was the last time we had this kind of focus and interest in legalizing marijuana. Now, to be honest, back in the 70s, the issue was not quite as far along, and so the question was, should we continue to arrest smokers? No one back then, at least not elected officials, seemed to have the courage to talk about regulating and taxing the market. They were trying to come up with this halfway step of decriminalizing the user. Nonetheless, beginning in 1973, when Oregon passed the first modified decriminalization law, adopting a $100 civil fine for possession of an ounce or less, by 1977, we had passed similar bills in 11 different states. So we were on a significant run. And at the time, frankly, we felt within 10 years we would probably have marijuana legal in this country. But what we fail to understand is sometimes those swings in public attitudes are dramatic, and once they start swinging back in the different direction, about all you can do is keep your head down and try to protect the territory that you've won, you know, when the public was behind you. From 1977, when Nebraska decriminalized marijuana, we didn't win another statewide reform proposal until 1996, when California finally legalized medical use. That was a long, dry spell. But again, even then, the issue from 95 on to the last couple of years was almost entirely focused on medical use. However, this last year or two, and especially with this economic downturn, the debate really has turned the corner, and people are beginning to take a fresh look at the question of why don't we just regulate and tax marijuana and use it as a revenue stream.
You mentioned the swing of public opinion coming quickly, and the book, High in America, details that swing toward the late 70s with the story of Normal and President Carter's drug czar, Peter Bourne. And I was just wondering if you'd give people a little of your perspective on that story, and then just overall your perspective on the book and its accuracy describing those times.
Well, what I would say is when I occasionally go back and take a look at the section that has to do with Dr. Bourne and the explosion that resulted in his resigning as the president's drug czar and my ending up a few months later stepping aside as executive director from Normal, I have to admit it was without question the dumbest thing I think I've ever done in my professional life, and I was an angry young man, to be honest. Like lots of people that work on social issues, I was motivated by the anti-war movement, and once I got involved in it and started working on Normal and the project to legalize marijuana, I took it seriously, and I took it personally, and so I was an angry young man. And frankly, what I failed to do in that incident, the president's drug advisor, Dr. Peter Bourne, had shown up at a Normal party here in Washington, D.C. It was a big party that we threw every year at a private home, and there were bands playing, and there were several, you know, a couple of hundred, maybe 300 people there, and there was a lot of drug use. And at some point, the word got out to some of the media that were there that the president's drug advisor was upstairs getting high with me and some friends. Hunter Thompson and a number of other people were up there. When that story first broke, rather than denying it and trying to protect Dr. Bourne, I was so angry about some of the things that were going on in the policy. In particular, they were spraying paraquat on marijuana right across the border in Mexico, and we had evidence that it was coming across the border, and we were very concerned that marijuana smokers were going to be poisoned in this country. And yet the Carter administration, even though they said they favored decriminalizing marijuana, continued to spray paraquat on marijuana. Mm. So when the press came to me to ask me about the story they'd heard of Dr. Bourne, what I should have said, I should have just said, no, I don't know anything about it. I think it's all made up. But instead of protecting him, I said, I will neither confirm nor deny. Now, in Washington, when you say you will neither confirm nor deny what that is, that's only slightly coded version of saying you're on to something there. And it was perceived that way, and I ended up embarrassing myself and embarrassing Normal. As I say, Peter Bourne would have had to resign either way because he had some other problems. His assistant had been caught with some quaaludes, and it turns out that Dr. Bourne had prescribed those quaaludes to
him. Oh, no.
And I don't think they were prescribed for a medical purpose back then. They were usually used in conjunction with an active social life. I think Dr. Bourne would have had to resign either way, but it should not have had anything to do with Normal. And, it was the biggest mistake I ever made in my life professionally. And I think it did set us back for a few years. President Jimmy Carter, for example, who had been a big supporter of decriminalizing marijuana, never mentioned the subject again after that, naturally.
Well, we were talking about the difference between the 70s era and today. I guess one difference we could point out is nobody says quaaludes anymore.
That's right. Some of the drugs of choice have changed over the years. I guess now they'd be talking about OxyContin or something. I'm not even sure what drugs are out there today.
I guess it would be. So as far as Pat Anderson's book, this High in America book, do you feel it's a pretty accurate representation of the Normal history?
I'll tell you what I think. First off, I should tell your listeners that Pat Anderson is a friend of mine. I've known him since the mid-70s. I knew him when he was a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter before he ever came to me about writing this book. So we've been friends all along, and we are friends still today. We get together once a month or something and have dinner. But I did think that Pat's read on things was a little simplistic and maybe a little unsympathetic to Normal. We made a lot of mistakes when we were young, but they were mistakes that were not malevolent. You know, we weren't looking to do things wrong. We were trying to do things right, but we were young and we were learning, and we were sometimes making the right moves, and frankly, sometimes we were making the wrong moves. We had to reverse course and try another tact. So it seemed to me, when I occasionally go back and read sections of that book, that the book wasn't as sympathetic to Normal as I think perhaps it should have been. But having said that, I will also tell you that in terms of just the basic facts of how things occurred from, say, 1970 was when Normal was formed until the end of the 70s when we had those 11 states that had decriminalized, it's quite accurate about that. So it's a book that I think people who are curious about the 1970s and the marijuana law reform effort would learn a lot from reading, no doubt. Mm.
You know, we talked about that Bourne incident and how the movement to decriminalize or legalize marijuana kind of got derailed by these cocaine stories. Just recently here in the news media, we've been hearing some tabloid rumors about Ashley Biden's possible use of cocaine on a videotape. Do you fear that happening with the modern marijuana movement, that it might be overshadowed by, say, methamphetamine or cocaine or prescription drug abuse, and the confusion over the issue might derail the marijuana issue?
I don't think the risk is so great today as it was back in the 70s. The cocaine use was much more prevalent, for example, in the mid and late 1970s. And so frequently, if you were talking about marijuana, you found somebody also talking about cocaine policy, and it scared people to think about legalizing cocaine. Today, frankly, cocaine use is way down, amphetamine use is way down, so most marijuana smokers don't use any other drug, or if they do, it's an illegal drug, it's alcohol. So I'm not so worried about problems in the Biden family, for example. I've seen some of those same reports. If those are true and they're confirmed, it's going to be an embarrassment to the vice president, because he's always been a strong drug warrior. But I don't think it's going to have the kind of impact that the Bourne incident did, because, again, whatever her problems are, they had nothing to do with the drug law reform movement. She just apparently had some friends who were not very good friends and decided to take a picture of her when she was snorting a line of cocaine and then to offer to sell it for $1 million to the media.
Yeah, how sad.
Now, I do think people want to be careful. When these incidents come along where a public official is embarrassed by drug use by their kids or something like that, we do want to be careful, because they can sometimes backfire. You know, sometimes someone who would otherwise be sympathetic to our public policy position may be afraid to endorse us or push our issue because it looks like they're doing it only to help their own son or daughter. So, you know, you can never tell. On one hand, I would like to think that if the vice president's daughter is now officially going to acknowledge that, yes, she sometimes uses cocaine, that perhaps the vice president ought to slow down a minute and rethink his own position. And maybe it doesn't make sense that we send all drug users to jail, because he wouldn't want his own daughter going to jail. That's how I would like to think it would impact policy. But it doesn't always work that way.
We'll continue with part two of our interview of Keith Straup, the founder of Normal, discussing more about the history of Normal and Normal's future in the 21st century. Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another reminder to get in touch with your senators and tell them to support Jim Webb and Arlen Specter's Senate Bill 714, the National Criminal Justice Commission Act of 2009. You can reach your senators by calling 202-224-3121. They'll simply ask for your zip code and put you in touch with your senators. Now remember, you've got two senators, so you're going to need to make two phone calls. Tell them to support Senate Bill 714. Thanks for downloading the podcast and getting involved with your own liberation and standing up for an end to adult marijuana prohibition. Alone, this is impossible, but together, this is achievable. we will end this prohibition in my lifetime, if not sooner. We'll be back tomorrow with more news and interviews you can use for the cannabis community. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.